You don't have access to information. You're not able to reach your family and friends. You are left in a state of confusion.
Online cuts fail to silence Myanmar voices. It's Monday, February 8th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Find us online at VOA Asia Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Also ahead, fighting fire with fire technology, controlling countries and diaspora, vaccine passports, U.S. political fractures, making Tibetan egg noodles. It's all on today's VOA Asia. As part of its power grab last week, Myanmar's military cut access to the internet. Still, tens of thousands of people have been able to coordinate and gather in large outdoor protests against the coup. Efforts to control information are tactics that are being seen in other parts of the world, as Isha Sarai reports.
As the military seized power in Myanmar, it intermittently cut off access to the internet. That affected the ability of citizens to communicate, get information about the coup, and, of course, the ability of journalists to cover the crisis.
On Monday, my colleague were out of reach for, 3 or 4 hours when the military totally shut down not only internet, mobile, services. So they didn't come online. And on the morning, we were, having very early newsroom meetings and how we are going to report. And then, 7 a.m., they all gone.
Internet shutdowns in Myanmar are not new.
In the context of Myanmar, internet shutdowns have been happening over the past years. I mean, there are a number of townships in the Rakhine and Chin states that have not had internet connection or have been throttled, reduced internet connection for a long time.
Internet cuts have been tracked in Uganda, Ethiopia's Tigray region, Belarus, and India, among other countries, around times of contested elections, protests, or civil unrest. In Kashmir, access to fast internet has been blocked since India revoked the contested region's special status in 2019. India says the blocks are needed to fight extremism and false news.
Whenever, even right now, if there is a gun battle in South Kashmir, the government will suspend internet of that area.
Internet blackouts, slowing the internet, and blocking websites make access to information more difficult.
When you find yourself in a crisis and you don't have access to information, you're not able to reach your family and friends, you are left in a state of confusion.
So much so that the UN has declared internet blackouts unlawful.
They're a very blunt instrument that is being used to cut off people's right to access information.
The state of the internet in Myanmar has changed regularly over the past week, but journalists and activists say they remain determined to communicate. Isha Sarai, VOA News, Washington.
We remain part of the internet. Follow us daily on our Twitter stream at VOA Asia. We're also on Facebook at VOA Asia, and you can find our programs at voanews.com. These are among some of the top Asia headlines you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. Tens of thousands in Myanmar protest military coup. Australian advisor detained in Myanmar. Hopes fade for climbers missing on Pakistan's Savage Mountain. Drastic declines in Cambodia's endangered wildlife. Chinese whistleblower honored on anniversary of his death. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more can be found at Facebook at VOA Asia. Also stop by the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Technology that can predict bushfires is being developed in Australia, one of the world's most fire-prone countries. It will offer real-time visual displays of how fires are likely to spread, and it comes as dozens of homes have already been destroyed this year by fires on the outskirts of the Western Australian state capital, Perth. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Bushfires are a perennial menace in Australia. This week, Perth has confronted twin emergencies, raging flames and a coronavirus lockdown.
When I had to evacuate, I didn't want to come to the evacuation centre because I, obviously with the lockdown, I was so concerned that this was going to be like a COVID hotspot. Yeah, grabbed my animals and just headed straight for the beach, actually. I ended up trying to sleep in my car.
An emergency or a natural disaster can happen no matter where you are, whether you're at home, work, or travelling.
Firefighting in Australia is becoming increasingly sophisticated. A new simulator is being developed to predict well in advance how bushfires will move across the landscape. Currently, there are varying systems of modelling bushfires across Australian states and territories. The new technology could give emergency crews a critical advantage. Mahesh Prakash, a senior principal research scientist at Australia's National Science Agency, CSIRO, is working in collaboration with other organisations.
We take real-time weather as well as satellite data feeds for being able to predict the bushfires. We also take fuel and vegetation inputs. We are also working with state-based emergency management agencies who are trialing it out as we speak on a monthly basis while we are developing new features in the system as well as making it more robust. In the Australian context, we are intending it to be a nationally operational system over the next 2 to 3 years. We are also engaging with agencies in the US such as CAL FIRE, as well as with a few organizations in Europe, especially ones based in Spain, Portugal, and Italy.
During Australia's unforgettable Black Summer disaster of 2019 and 20, 24 million hectares of land were burned, 33 people died, and more than 3,000 homes were destroyed. An official report into the tragedy warned that bushfires would become more complex, more unpredictable, and more difficult to manage. Authorities said Saturday that most of the huge fire that has been threatening parts of Perth had now been contained. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This news from VOA Asia. Tens of thousands of people took to the streets across Myanmar for a second day Sunday to protest last week's military coup and call for the release of elected leader Aung San Suu Kyi. Demonstrations that began in different parts of Yangon converged on the center of the city. Large crowds reported in other cities as well. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. We're glad to have you with us as we all begin a brand new week at VOA Asia. The pro-democracy group Freedom House has released a report detailing how countries such as China, among others, systematically employ violence and intimidation against exiles and diasporas to silence dissent beyond their borders. VOA's diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
The world recoiled in horror when prominent journalist and U.S. resident Jamal Khashoggi was murdered in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in October 2018. Khashoggi became the face of a practice known as transnational repression, when a dissident flees a country yet still faces persecution in exile. Freedom House released a report documenting the practice.
The report is really our effort to try to describe the global scale and scope of this phenomenon and to put some numbers and to put some figures and to put some faces behind something that happens to many people all around the world.
The report says there have been at least 608 cases of transnational repression since 2014, including assassinations, abductions, assaults, detentions, and unlawful deportations. It includes case studies of six leading states that target exiles and diaspora communities: China, Rwanda, Saudi Arabia, Russia, Iran, and Turkey. Even high-profile dissidents are targets of authoritarian leaders, in a practice that Freedom House says has been normalized.
Not only the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, but, for instance, the kidnapping of Paul Rusesabagina, a very famous Rwandan activist who was living abroad, who was kidnapped in August. The kidnapping of multiple Iranian dissidents in the last year. The assassination repeatedly of Chechens, especially in Europe, by Russian authorities.
Another prominent case is Lujain al-Houdlou, a Saudi activist who helped win the right for women to drive. She was kidnapped from the United Arab Emirates in 2018 and imprisoned in Saudi Arabia, where she says she is being tortured. To help stop such cases, the report urges democratic nations, including the United States, to review their asylum, deportation, and rendition policies to prevent future repression. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
VOA Asia Facebook is the choice of millions to see and read the latest stories about Asia and the United States. Follow us on VOA Asia Facebook and say hello online or on your smartphone. Subscribe to all of our platforms for free. See, hear, and read and share all of the latest from VOA Asia anytime. VOA Asia is your trusted source for news and great features.
Happening now in Asia, officials say more than 140 people are missing and feared dead after a large piece of a Himalayan glacier in northern India broke off and slammed into a dam early Sunday, flooding and forcing the evacuation of downstream villages. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. As we continue with VOA Asia, and as more people get the COVID-19 vaccine, healthcare experts are tackling the issue of how someone can prove they've been vaccinated. Lisa Bakalitz tells us more in her story, narrated by Anna Rice.
A short form, a number of health-related questions, a quick shot, and then a vaccine card. That's the standard process when someone gets a COVID-19 vaccine in the U.S. The vaccination card is a small paper that the health professional fills out by hand. Maryland school teacher Maran Sivaslan got one recently.
She told me I can't lose it. I have to have it, and I have to make sure I take it with me when I get my second dose.
The vaccination card is a reminder that in 3 weeks it's time for the second dose, but also a backup for the nation's electronic record keeping.
So everybody who gets a COVID-19 vaccine in the U.S., in the state that they're in, that information gets electronically put into the registry.
But Tan says he believes the vaccination certificate can easily be falsified and wants a new system the World Health Organization is considering.
I think there has to be validation. There has to be a way to validate that information, which is why I think having something that is digitally secure, which is what the smart certificate that WHO is looking at, is needed.
The World Health Organization already has a so-called yellow card, which essentially serves as an official vaccination record needed to enter certain countries. The idea is to do the same for COVID-19 vaccinations. The International Air Transportation Association is suggesting a vaccination app.
Travel Pass is essentially an app which will be designed to be downloaded on a customer's phone, either directly from Apple iOS or Google Play for Android, or through an airline's app. And eventually that would allow a customer to be able to digitally identify themselves.
The International Economic Forum is also working on developing a similar digital passport, an app called Common Pass. It's an IBM platform to store all the medical data.
So in the U.S., everybody is required to send the vaccination activities to the state. And the state keeps this information into a registry. And what we are working on now is connecting the platform to the registries. So we can also expose that information back to you.
But relying on an app worries human rights activists, who stress that not everyone has a smartphone.
Connecting vaccination with the need to have an expensive smartphone doesn't serve civil liberties or civil rights purposes.
Developers say the apps should be fully functional by the end of 2021. Officials say a lot depends on how fast vaccinations are administered around the world and when countries reopen their borders. Фалеся Бакалец in Washington, NRI's VOA News.
Making headlines in Asia, a Chinese foreign ministry spokesperson says China's English language broadcaster CGTN has expressed strong opposition after Britain's media regulator revoked its license, saying the Chinese Communist Party had ultimate editorial responsibility for the channel. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, a fight over the future of the U.S. Republican Party is underway as former President Donald Trump faces a second impeachment trial. VOA's Kane Faribault reports from the Midwest state of Illinois, where a Republican congressman is weathering intense blowback for demanding his party turn the page on Trump in the aftermath of the January 6th assault on the U.S. Capitol.
Illinois Republicans like Shirley Prescott are turning on one of their own.
We are mad. We are furious. We will never vote for him again.
The focus of their anger is Congressman Adam Kinzinger.
The Republican Party has lost its way.
Kinzinger voted to impeach former President Donald Trump after a mob of his supporters assaulted the U.S. Capitol January 6th. And wants the Republican Party to expunge Trump's brand of politics.
By poisonous conspiracies and lies. This is not the Republican road.
Our congressman has, in our opinion, gone off the rails and said things that we don't agree with.
The county Republican Party in Kinzinger's district recently voted to censure him.
What he's been saying about our former president and his supporters and a lot of conservative Republicans is not okay.
But local Republican opinion is not unified.
Proud to be a Republican. I can't see anyone saying that right now. After what has happened, I can't see it. Who could be proud of this? Of these people running around in red hats and being mean to other people for no reason other than they don't love Trump.
Thornton and Smith's opposing views illustrate a growing fault line in a party where tens of millions of voters remain intensely loyal to a former president many others view as toxic. Now an independent, Thornton nevertheless backs Kinzinger and nine other Republican lawmakers in the House who voted to make Trump the first U.S. president twice impeached.
It did take courage. It did.
It could also put political careers in jeopardy. Larry Smith wants Republicans to replace Kinzinger in the next election cycle.
Kinzinger has earned himself a primary.
This kind of schism over the loyalty to Trump, I think, creates the opportunity for potentially more primary challengers.
Northwestern University's Laurel Harbridge Young says banishing anti-Trump Republicans could make the party less palatable to the general voting public.
It points to how members are more focused on a small number of people in their constituency. Their primary electorate, and even within that, this kind of ardent base, whose interests may not be the same as the rest of their constituents.
Susan Thornton welcomes Kinzinger's battle to reform the party, but says more is needed before she would consider herself a Republican again.
They would have to disavow Trump as a leader, as their messenger, because his message is not acceptable to me. We'd have to get back to decency and respect.
Trump loyalists say they are planning more events across the United States targeting lawmakers like Kinzinger, pledging to reshape the party in Trump's image, one primary election at a time. Kane Faribault, VOA News, Ottawa, Illinois.
Facebook's independent oversight board is deciding whether the social media firm's ban of former President Trump from Facebook and Instagram was the right call or should be reversed. Tina Trin logs on for more.
As former President Donald Trump faces an impeachment trial in the U.S. Senate, he faces another court of sorts, the Facebook Oversight Board. It will decide whether the internet company's decision to indefinitely block the former president from Facebook and Instagram was the right call.
In a way, it's an experiment.
And I think many people believe that this is the way forward, because the alternative is, I think, for the government to be making the rules, or Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg to make be making those decisions.
Endi Bayuni, an Indonesian journalist, is one of 20 members of the oversight board.
We take into account, of course, Facebook's standards, Facebook values, and international human rights laws.
Members recently issued their first rulings, and in 4 out of 5 cases overturned Facebook's decisions to remove content. Facebook complied with the board's decisions and reinstated the posts.
Please welcome the 45th...
After Trump's appearance at a January 6 rally, Facebook referred its decision to ban Trump to the board for review, and also asked for a review of how it should handle speeches by world leaders. Some are asking if the board itself makes sense.
This is sort of like Walmart, you know, or Aston Martin or Jaguar or something, deciding to have a court, right? Which is really very strange.
The social media giant is acting as if it were a sovereign nation with its own court structure, says law professor Lillian Edwards.
The more people discuss what the board does, the less they discuss whether there should be a board at all.
Others blame an absence of government regulation that tech companies can easily fill.
It doesn't solve the structural problems of the business models, of the algorithmic amplification of hatred that I think have to be addressed.
Board member Bayuni says the goal is not to replace government regulations.
We don't see ourselves as a substitute to the laws in the different countries. You know, that's for them to decide. But we are here to help in content moderation.
The board is accepting public comment on Facebook's Trump ban and expects to make a decision as soon as possible. Tina Trin, VOA News, New York.
It's hard enough for a woman to run a successful business in northern India, but when it comes to egg noodles, making your mark can be even more difficult. VOA's Kalsang Jigme reports one Tibetan woman who's running a business her way.
Each morning at 5 a.m., Namtsuki is up preparing the day's amdogadu, or egg noodles, for her clients in Dharamsala, India. It's a long and labor-intensive process.
We start drying the noodles in the morning, right when sun rises. The noodles get dried by the afternoon around 3 p.m.
He works in Dharamsala in northern India, not too far from Jammu and Kashmir and Tibet. She has spent years perfecting her recipes. That attention to detail has made her fans all over the region and beyond.
We get calls from different shops telling us what they want. The packages of noodles are delivered to different shops. Our egg noodles are distributed across the different Himalayan regions. It is challenging to send our noodles to South India.
She came to India from Tibet in the 1990s and started her own business. Thankfully, Ki says she didn't have to start from scratch.
This factory has been there for more than 20 years. The first owner had named his noodles Amdo Gadro Thukpa, Amdo Happy Egg Noodles. I did not change the name of the noodles.
She says, as someone who came from another country, starting her own business was simply a way to survive.
Coming to a foreign land, you have no choice but to stand up on our own feet, get a job on your own, and find your own livelihood. No one is going to be helping you. That's how we decided to run this noodle company.
Despite the cultural hardships of being an immigrant and a woman, her business has been successful. So successful, Ki is beginning to expand and has begun shipping noodles into neighboring Tibetan settlements in India. This is Lhapa Kinzum for Kelsang Jingmi in Dharamsala, India, for VOA News.
VOA Asia continues online. Although our program has concluded for the day, you may continue on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. And we invite you back for more VOA Asia tomorrow. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to those who helped bring this program to you, our managing editor Diane Gao, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Amy Hybels. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a terrific day ahead. Be safe. Be well.